So I think to bring out some of this discussion, I think we had great talks, fantastic talks, really innovative stuff. I'm going to present some cases to this panel and see what they would do with them and where they agree and where they disagree. I am the principal investigator for the multicenter randomized controlled trial, the acute study of AB103 that was referred to. That is ongoing. I'm not going to talk about that in this talk. And I previously served as a consultant for the company that is sponsoring that trial. Okay, so let's start with the first case. You guys ready? All right, this is a 27-year-old gentleman who presented to a community hospital. These are true cases, by the way. And he was complaining of severe pain in his right shoulder. He denies any history of injection drug use, not sure what happened, but has this horrible pain in his shoulder. You can see there his vital signs. He's tachycardic. He's febrile. He's got a white count of 25,000, a sodium of 130. His hematocrit is 50, and his creatinine is 2. So these are some of those bad labs that I think Dr. Disanaki was concerned about. He has erythema that extends over the deltoid and some punctate areas of bluish discoloration. And this community hospital surgeon says, this looks bad. I'm going to take him to the hospital for exploration. So after that, they decide they're going to transfer him to us for further management because they're concerned about necrotizing soft tissue infection after that initial debridement. And Rudy requires some vasopressors. These are his admission labs now at the tertiary care center. His white count's come down, but he still has a really marked left shift, still hyponatremic. His creatinine has risen. His lactate is up, and his platelets are down. His wound is evaluated by us, and we think he needs some more debridement. I'll show you those pictures in a minute. What antibiotics would you start him on, Dr. May?
did they have a Gram stain at all?
I don't have that. Nope, they didn't
no
do that.
Gram stain and,
nope. You have no information.
Any knowledge of gas on?
Lots of skin necrosis. In fact, I'll show you the wound if you want to see it. This is the debridement they did at the other hospital. So now the top there is a tattoo. Let me make sure you can see that. Let me see if I can do it with the mouse. This is a tattoo, but all of this is necrotic skin here. No antibiotics.
So we'd start them on broad spectrum, probably either Zosyn or carbapenem plus. Most likely this would be a Gram positive, need Gram positive coverage, so high dose clindamycin.
So high dose clindamycin.
And without any other knowledge, you may need some anti staphylococcal.
Yeah, MRSA. We have a lot of MRSA. We cover these routinely for MRSA. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so clindamycin.
And you're not going to be able to save his tattoo, unfortunately.
Not going to save what?
His tattoo.
You don't think so? No. All right, we're trying to be cosmetically sensitive. Carrie, are these skin-sparing incisions appropriate here?
They are skin-sparing, but they're not appropriate. So if I was to debride this or to help consult on debriding this, what you want to do is essentially draw a circle around all of it that's dead and then cut that out. And then from there, start doing blunt dissection with your finger in all directions. And you're going to extend linearly from over any direction that you've got undermining. And that can include going all the way down where that lateral arm incision is, separately into the axilla. And then if you need to, I'd make a curvilinear incision that extends from essentially the posterior fold of the axilla down toward the midline of the lower back, which is the incision you'd make over the latissimus. Then you can stick your hand up and down. It'll expose the whole back, essentially, and you can extend it up anteriorly. I can't see the front of him, but over the clavicle or just inferior to the clavicle so you can get onto the pec.
Can I make one point just about the extension of tissue planes?
Absolutely.
Not relevant here. He's young, but in a geriatric patient, it can be very difficult because their tissue planes are so easily dissected. That can be very difficult to tell where the end of the extension has gone.
So in that case, do you do frozen sections or any of that? Do you believe in that?
I have in the past, but not usually. Just sort of takes a bit more attention to the tissue planes and whether or not they visibly look infected and whether they're visibly adherent or not.
Yeah, I agree. I've not found frozen sections to be very helpful. Sharmila, your comments?
So just a comment I would make is it's sometimes harder to tell if you don't do this a lot like all of us here do And so we've learned what's dead and what's not dead. That's sometimes surprisingly hard to teach people who don't see it a lot. The shades of yellow and the shades of gray and the fat, mm-hmm. for example, that tell you and how you can tell dead fascia, because fascia looks gray even when it's healthy sometimes. So I do think some of this, and when I look at something like this, which is clearly a bit of a dramatic example, it's mm-hmm. clearly someone who doesn't recognize what's dead and what's not dead. And I think sometimes perhaps that's something we should be taking a little more time to teach instead of sort of the high-level stuff up here,
sure.
just the simple diagnosis on tissues.
Okay. So I'll show you... This is the front of his shoulder, just around the other side of that tattoo. And I think what was one of the things that was concerning to us is if you can see that there's this discoloration really extends up. This is his neck. This is a line in his neck, right? Really extends up also onto the chest wall here, too. So sometimes these can be really quite progressive. And we didn't do too much skin sparing here, I admit. We did a little bit down here, maybe. And he had very large pleural effusion, so he had a chest tube as well because he's having difficulty oxygenating. But that's the back of the debridement. This is the front, again, extending a little bit over onto that chest wall. So now he's admitted to the ICU, and he's coagulopathic, and we've given him some transfusions. His post-op labs, his white count is 18, his lactate is 6.3, despite pretty aggressive fluid resuscitation, I would say, by the anesthesiologist. Gram stain shows gram-positive cocci. Norepinephrine and vasopressin are now started for septic shock. So when would you come back to the operating room? Dr. May, you have a gram stain. Are you happy with your antibiotic selection? Would you change anything?
Yeah, no, I'd probably leave the antibiotic selection the same until you get a little more data on the gram-positive cocci. And if he's not clinically responding, he'd probably go back within 12 hours.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that paper from East was alluded to. The literature in this topic is not great, I would say. And that paper was an evidence-based review of the literature. And so the best we could say from the literature was 12 hours. For the initial debridement. But I totally agree with the panelists who said this is a surgical emergency, and we have to treat it as such. And so for the initial debridement, getting into the operating room as quickly as possible, starting antibiotics as quickly as possible, I think are important factors. And then really watching these patients for progression of disease. You would have left that whole wound open there, Dr. Jasnacki?
Oh. Absolutely. That's like the perfect kind of wound to leave open. I would have safe gelled. You had a little bit of exposed tendon over there. The muscles do okay with the sprints mm-hmm. usually. If they start to dry out, I'd have put a little gel on that too. But absolutely, that's exactly the kind of wound okay. you would have left open.
And I'm not hearing any support for any other adjuncts. Nobody would do hyperbaric oxygen here for this patient?
Yeah. No. So I might be tempted from some data to give him some thiamine and vitamin C just for giggles. Just from what the sepsis
for
data
sepsis,
is going.
Broadly sepsis.
For broadly sepsis uh-huh. data, not for NSTIs. There's no data. Uh-huh. But given that there's a little bit of data in the sepsis and we're mm-hmm. kind of losing the battle here, this would be my throw the kitchen sink without the data approach. Uh-huh. But I would consider vitamin C, thiamine, and then I might maybe check for steroid responsiveness and consider a stress dose of hydrocortisone. And mm-hmm. I know that's a little bit, you know.
Controversial.
Controversial.
Yes. Dr. May, would you use IVIG for this patient?
Would not.
Do you use IVIG for any patients anymore?
No.
Okay, just checking. All right. Yeah, we've largely gone away from IVIG as well. I think again, data's not great, but though most of the data would suggest it doesn't make much difference. So, okay, let's try another one. Let's make it. Let's see if we can get into the diabetic realm. So this is a 50-year-old homeless gentleman with a history of diabetes and schizophrenia. He presents to your emergency department after self-amputating his first toe. Because it was uncomfortable, and black. He has some erythema and edema and crepitus that extends to the ankle. Above the ankle, the skin looks totally normal, but he's complaining of severe pain in his left hip. His white count is 25, his creatinine is 2.5, his sodium is 130, and his blood pressure you see there, Dr. Jasnacki.
I just want to point out that you picked the exact same labs that I did and said that we focused on. So I'm just going to point
perhaps,
that out.
Perhaps we agree
exactly
on that.
The same one. Yeah.
Might be because I trained you, but that's
Should
another
be.
Issue.
Maybe.
Okay, so would you do any other imaging? Would you take him to the operating room and explore his foot? What would you do here?
I would image him to see why he's got the pain in the hip.
In the hip.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's no skin findings above the ankle, though. But it could be something going on in the hip, you think? Maybe? Okay. Let's see. Well, we got some plain films, and I know that's old school. Maybe you can see this gas tracking up the back of the leg above the ankle. That goes all the way up. And maybe you can see this gas up here in the flank, in the hip. You all see that?
Yeah.
Would you get a CT scan now?
I think you have your diagnosis. I don't necessarily think you need a CT scan. If you're worried about intra-abdominal, you could say so. But, I mean, I would just go and operate and be prepared to go intra-abdominal if the clinical signs at OR dictated it.
So would you empirically make your incisions up the back of the leg, over the hip?
So that's a good question. I'm not sure you know where that gas is. If it's in the fascial layer outside the torso, you're one incision. If it's a fascial layer up the psoas, that's another incision.
Mm-hmm. So you're favoring a CT scan?
I would CT.
Okay. Well, we didn't. We took him to the operating room, but what we did was we explored the foot and we tracked. We made a skin sparing incision up the back of the leg, and then we made an incision over the hip and we debrided there. But we were able to do skin sparing up the entire leg. Ended up with a through ankle amputation, however, due to the extensive necrosis in the foot. What antibiotics for him? Is he different from the other guy, Dr. May?
I certainly would check to see if you have any data from previous cultures for that wound. Sometimes they're chronic wounds and you have previous cultures, so you've got to make sure you're covering what's in a chronic wound.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I think the agents that we use for the previous patient would be what we'd use here.
Same thing.
I'm just going to give one thought, not for this early stage, but down the road. This is one wound to just have in the very back of your mind, two organisms that would otherwise be maybe uncommon is Pseudomonas, for where I'm at, Pseudomonas acinetobacter, sometimes in this sort of presentation. The other thing that is very rare, but starting to get a little bit more common, at least in my region, is mold, not early, but late, that it starts to present after you've knocked out all the other things, the patient's getting better, and then they stall, get worse, and die. Mm-hmm. We've actually had some intraosseous to systemic mold infections. Still rare, but we've had two this year after zero for the previous 20 years. So I just kind of bring that up because it's rare enough that you won't diagnose it unless you know what that black dead tissue in the bone looks like. And I just kind of want to make that point.
Okay. And this particular patient, he's schizophrenic, and he's agitated, and he's delirious, and he's refusing to discuss the amputation with you at all. Is that a problem? You got to take him to the operating room. He actually ended up needing an amputation. So how do you get consent? Any concerns about that? What would you do? He doesn't have any family. He's homeless.
So we would get an emergency guardianship order on this patient because if he's schizophrenic and in acute psychosis, then by definition he's not capable of consent.
Mm-hmm. No problem taking him to the operating room. This is a surgical emergency, right? Yeah? Okay.
Correct.
Just checking. All right, this is an interesting case. This is a 40-year-old woman. She's diabetic. She's morbidly obese. And she presents to an outside hospital. Her complaint is abdominal pain, and she's in DKA. Her white count's 20, sodium 130, creatinine's normal. And all she has is some mild discoloration of the right hip. Okay? And this is when I saw her. They described it as even being fainter, much fainter than that. So that's her complaint. They got a CT scan, and I want you to look at the CT scan over here. This is the one they got, and it didn't show any gas. It just showed some, a little bit of thickening here, and so they elected to put her on some antibiotics, admit her, and treat her for her DKA. After 24 hours, she was worse, having more pain, having signs of sepsis, and so they got that repeat CT scan. Let me go back there. And now you can see that same area, there's some gas in the tissues there. So your thoughts on this case? Would you have acted on this first CT scan over here? I know the end, yeah. but try to put yourself in the shoes of this community surgeon.
I think the CT scan less than the skin findings. It's hard to produce those skin findings from just a inflammatory erythema is one thing, but dark discoloration is very concerning.
Yeah, so I think some of the challenges, how do you distinguish, you know, sort of panocellulitis from necrotizing soft tissue infection? Panocellulitis is pretty common. So you're looking at the sort of darkish color of it, you think?
Correct.
Bluish discoloration?
Okay. It's not in the right spot for panocellulitis, which I see a lot of. Panocellulitis is usually dependent, and it doesn't usually extend outside the panus onto the hip in this way.
Yeah.
And it's irregular, it's asymmetric, and the labs. I mean, it's unusual for cellulitis to show you that high a white count. So I think there was enough clinical concern, frankly, that the CT is just adding to it.
Okay. All right. So
there's some questions out in the audience.
Is the skin anesthetic? Oh, actually, she's complaining of severe pain. Yeah, not anesthetic, painful.
You mean you actually want to do a physical exam? That's novel.
He's asking if the skin is anesthetic, and I'm saying she's complaining of such severe pain, if you touch her, she yelps. Okay, so they got this repeat CT scan, and now she's pretty sick, and so they decided to transfer her. So she comes to see me, and when I see her, now she's got this discoloration on the central panus. Can you see that? Can you see this? So I showed you what the hip looked like, and now we have this. So this is our incision, skin sparing.
I just want to point out that the lower abdomen is one of the best places to get to start with if you're nervous about doing these, because this is essentially doing an abdominoplasty, and it's very easy to get way up on the abdominal wall.
Yeah. So you can see there we had to debride a large amount of the fascia here, but we're able to spare most of the skin, and she ended up eventually getting a primary closure. Okay, so now we're going to do a urology case, because poor Dr. Rohammer's here, and he's our urologist, and he hasn't had anything to say yet, so this is your case, Josh. So this is a 60-year-old man with a history of diabetes, presents with severe pain in the scrotum, which has been worsening over the last 72 hours, and you're consulted. And this is what you find. What do you think?
Well, it looks pretty bad. I would typically, as a urologist, I do get primary calls on these. I quickly usually mobilize my critical care team to help with the resuscitation. I would favor imaging on this, simply because there are some intra-abdominal processes, especially that may start pararectal abscesses, for instance, may be presenting in the retroperitoneum, and we've had many cases where we've done a scrotal debridement and then found that there's pus or things tracking through the inguinal canal, and then the patient requires abdominal exploration. So I'd usually start broad-spectrum antibiotics on this. I do think a CT is warranted, assuming the patient's stable.
Okay. And then your operative approach to these generally, do you start in the scrotum? What positioning? What do you do?
I usually do these in dorsal lithotomy. I think rectal exam is important. I mean, these usually in the perineum are either a periurethral source or a perirectal source, and so that a lot of times will guide where we're going. The perirectal tend to track posteriorly, and so you've got to be prepared to be able to debride. We've even had to flip the patient sometimes in order to complete that debridement.
Yeah, I agree with these, and we frequently will do these as sort of joint cases between general surgery, urology, because of the perineal involvement or sometimes extension up into the groin as well. Dr. May, you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to say one fine detail about the skin-sparing incisions. There are many places in the body that serve as sort of a bowl. The one thing you want to do is prevent fluid collections. The skin on the buttocks, if you've got incisions higher up, but there's skin that serves as a bowl, that can be a significant problem. Sometimes in morbidly obese patients, anterior incisions, but it tracks posteriorly. So you want to make sure that you've either created an incision that will negate fluid collections posterior to that.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to add on to that because I've reconstructed a lot of these, and we have found that in Fournier's doing this, essentially where you remove most of the scrotal skin, but need to extend it a long linear incision that extends from that scrotal debridement through the perineum, usually just lateral to the perineum itself, and then along whichever side of the perianal area is most involved. As long as you make it long enough and pack in it, you're not creating, generally it doesn't extend over the gluteus maximus, and part of that is that the gluteus maximus fascia is unlike any of the other fascia in our body, and there's really not a fascial plane there. It's sort of this series, almost like the plantar foot, where you have like a series of vertical adhesions, and so it doesn't generally track laterally, so it prevents having that sort of soupy, scoopy area. But I have found that most of these that we actually do in the perianal region do very well with long slit-like incisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the incision that Dr. Brohammer made, and you can see it does extend up into the groin there, and those testicles are pretty exposed. Wound care for that, and what's the ultimate reconstruction with the testicles hanging out like that?
So I would generally do wet to dry dressings with Dakin's to start. There's a couple comments I'll make, and one is this patient may be open for quite some time, and so I'd recommend an early consideration for a suprapubic tube, because what will happen is with a catheter being in place for some time, especially if they go to a rehab facility or get delayed reconstruction, they'll get urethral erosion, which is very difficult to repair. It's actually sort of a pressure necrosis of the tip of the penis. Testicle-wise, we generally wrap them individually with wet-to-dry dressings, but very early on, we'll often, in our repeat debridements, once things are relatively clear and we're waiting to reduce the bacterial load prior to reconstruction, a few stitches in between the two testicles will actually hold them together. I've seen cases where patients have been—they've had a torsion based on just their wound changes at the bedside. So that's something you can obviously prevent. And one other comment: although this wound, the testicles look good in this particular area, very rarely do you have to do an orchiectomy. Occasionally, the blood supply of the testicles from the retroperitoneum, and as long as the process didn't start there, they're usually viable. We've had patients who've been debrided locally transferred to our center, and they didn't know what to do with the testicles, so they actually just took them off, which is devastating, especially if it's a young patient, because it'll require lifelong testosterone supplementation. So for us, I mean, this patient's debridement looks relatively minimal. We would probably do... We tend to avoid thigh pouches if we can. If you have 50% of the scrotum, you can close primarily, but we would mobilize skin flaps in this when they're ready to be constructed. I'd be curious how you guys would handle it, Washington.
Yeah, so early pexy is pretty important. We've reconstructed a couple patients who have such bad retraction of the cord that the testicle, one or both, are actually above or superior to the penile shaft, which is very disfiguring for the patients. For most of them, we'll see how far over we can get the residual scrotal skin, but I'd find the majority of our patients have very little or no scrotal skin left after debridement. And the testicles and penile shaft actually take graft very, very well. And so most of ours get grafted rather than trying to mobilize the lateral inguinal skin. And then that upper portion just gets closed primarily.
Yeah, the other comment about debridement as well is if the penile shaft skin's involved, if you take any proximal skin from around it, any distal skin that may be spared will get lymphedema during recovery. So it's if the penis skin's viable, leave it. But if it doesn't have good blood flow or there's not viable skin, take it all off because it does take a graft well and it
but
needs to be.
Not the gland skin.
Yes, not the glands. That's a great clarification, just shaft skin. The glands has a... extra blood supply and is very, very rarely involved.
Can I ask, do you mesh at a different ratio than you would other reconstructive areas?
So I trained at the University of Washington, and so when I do my skin meshing, we use a split thickness, split thickness graft, so usually about 0.18, and then we mesh 1:1. So the goal is not to spread the skin out, it's just a way to provide drainage. The traditional textbooks usually talk about doing a full thickness graft to the penis, and then I usually mesh 1:2 at the scrotum. The scrotum recovers well. It sort of looks textured in its natural appearance. I think doing a split thickness with more meshing is less morbid because we're taking less skin overall.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I also have tried full thickness because that's a traditional recommendation, and I find a good split thickness that's just a little thicker than usual is actually the best middle ground.
Okay.
Sorry, one more comment. Mm-hmm. The dressings for these, when they're grafted, it's an interesting area to try and dress. And one of the best ways that we've found is to do kind of a big turban. So you essentially put your nonstick layer against it, whether it's adaptic or conformant, and then sort of wind your gauze, not tightly, but loosely around the scrotum and then around the penile shaft and then sort of around the whole package until you have this kind of honeycomb or beehive-looking thing. And then we use moist, like essentially solution poured over the top to keep it in its native environment. Do you have a different dressing style that you like?
It just depends how much residual perineal and thigh skin. I do try to wound vac these. You can cut the wound vacs to make sort of little donut rings to go around the penis. But it just depends on, it's hard to get a seal, and generally I just try to do that long enough to keep the graft down for a few days. But typically we end up having to remove it just because it's perineum's hard to get completely vacced. It can be done, but it takes some persistence.
All right. Well, on that note, I think we're pretty much out of time, but I want to thank all the panelists. I think phenomenal presentations, great discussion. And if you have questions, please come up and ask them.